From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
So this bill is about those victims, to urge them to come forward knowing that they'll be protected if they help bring to justice the people behind the human trafficking rings.
Smoking is not a right and a benefit. Smoking is an addiction and a societal burden.
And I have 272 bills signed into law by four different governors. I take it as an offense when lobbyists saying that I'm lying and not giving people the opportunity to come and work with them on the bill.
The bill, having received the required 3/5 majority, is hereby declared passed, notwithstanding the veto of the governor.
Notwithstanding the veto of the governor.
Notwithstanding the veto of the governor.
Non obstante veto.
Well, the veto session is upon us, the first week complete. We'll talk about some of the issues that have come up, what might happen before the end of the month as well. And Bruce Rauner, governor who vetoed several pieces of legislation, not faring all that well so far in the veto session of seeing those hold up. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel for State Week includes Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House editor, and Daisy Contreras, State House reporter for NPR Illinois. Well, let's start by talking about some of these vetoes that took place, and we'll get into the overall look at how the governor fared a little bit later on. One of the first ones we heard there was Senator John Cullerton, Democrat and Senate President from Chicago, talking about what's known as the Voices Act. Daisy, fill us in. What would this do?
Yeah, so just a brief summary. It would require Illinois law enforcement officers to sign off on immigration paperwork within 90 business days for immigrant victims who help police and prosecutors bring criminals to justice. And this kind of already exists in the books, but there is no set deadline. So this would bring them to 90, make sure that they get 90 days, business days, for their paperwork to go through.
So why did the governor take the action to veto this?
He said this would be an unfunded mandate upon already strained state, local, and federal law enforcement agencies beyond what they can already do. So he didn't like that. And he got a lot of criticism from a lot of Democrats during the campaign for his veto of this measure.
And Brian, this veto came about, I think, when the governor seemed to be pivoting a little more conservative during the campaign. Would that be safe to say that this was part of that strategy?
Yeah, to put it mildly, I think. And this comes a year after he had signed a bill where he had gotten plaudits from some of those same people who later turned around and criticized him. He had signed what's called the Trust Act, which was about the idea was it was supposed to foster trust between immigrants, particularly undocumented immigrants, and law enforcement. And that had the support of law enforcement officers. There were a bunch of people in brown and blue uniforms standing behind the governor when he signed that one the first time around. And then when he sort of changed his approach a year later, a lot of people saw that as, you know, as you said, a move of him still tacking to the right to sort of shore up that conservative vote heading into the general election.
And advocates really painted this as something that, you know, it goes beyond the issue of or the rhetoric of illegal immigration. So in 2000, the federal government created a special immigration visas for victims of human trafficking and other crimes. So if anybody, you know, is abducted or kidnapped, this would help those victims get their immigration paperwork done faster.
Now, this did pass in the Senate, the override, and of course the Senate has a supermajority, so Democrats, for example, could have pushed that through. I don't know if any Republicans voted along with the colleagues there to override or not, but it goes to the House. There is not a supermajority of Democrats in that chamber, so we don't really know what the future holds for this, but I would think that it could have a bit tougher time.
I mean, that's true of all these bills, right? This is just the first week of veto session. All of them still have to go through the other chamber. However, this is a bill that actually gained votes from the spring when it passed initially. It had more votes on the override. So that suggests something that, and there are all different reasons that could happen. Perhaps people feel more free to vote their conscience. Maybe they got talked to about this bill, and they've come to view it in a different light post-election. But it seemed, at least on the Senate side, it gained support from the spring session into the veto session. So that conceivably could happen on the House side, too.
And Charlie, we often see that with legislators. For people that don't follow the legislature as closely, maybe as we do, we often see after an election, and especially with what's known as a lame duck legislature, a lot of people leaving in both sides. Oftentimes people feel more free to vote a certain way than they would if they were running for office.
Yeah, I think that's true because there's, in a sense, there's less pressure on you if you know that you're going to be leaving in a couple of weeks. Or I guess it'd be more like a couple of months at this point. You can not have to worry so much about offending interest groups, offending some of your constituents, and you're able to do things that perhaps before you thought, well, this is the right thing to do, but I don't really want to get in trouble with this particular group or this portion of my constituency, and so I'm not going to vote for it now. And now, as I say, you're kind of free of that burden, and you can, as somebody said earlier, you can just vote your conscience on this stuff.
One of those bills that seems like it could pick up some, at least to me, I think, from where I sit, could be this bill known as Tobacco 21. It would raise the age for purchasing tobacco products. And we've been hearing a lot in Illinois and across the country about the number of kids who are suddenly, due to vaping and other products that are out there, that they're getting more addicted to nicotine and to smoking than something we had been seeing really on the decline for so long. This did pass, an override did pass this week in the Senate. Now it goes to the House. This is one I know that, Brian, that retailers in many cases had been against and maybe some others as well. So still an uphill climb for it, but this seems like one with people leaving office they might be more apt to consider.
This is one that only gained one vote on the Senate side. It passed with a bare minimum veto proof majority to override the governor, 36 votes. When it originally came out of the House, it was well short of the number needed to override. So they need to pick up 10 more votes in the House in order to get this to override the governor here. And this, you're right, you have business interests who say that this would hurt retail sales. You also have a sort of libertarian argument here, which is that, you know, we ask 18-year-olds to go overseas and fight in the military on our behalf. We ought to trust them to make their own decisions about using, you know, what is still a legal product. But, you know, on the other hand, you have public health advocates who say that this, you know, if you can stop teenagers from picking up the smoking habit, they are much less likely to continue on smoking for the rest of their lives, and that just leads to a lot healthier population. So it's still, ultimately, to get to your main question, though, mm-hmm. this is an uphill climb in the House.
And Charlie, that we've heard that argument before, that libertarian argument about, you can go off and fight in a war someplace. You should be allowed to, if you want to buy cigarettes at 18, you should be allowed to do it. Maybe if you want to have a beer, we heard it with the alcohol legislation many years ago when that age was raised as well.
Yeah, and the argument is, it goes beyond just age things. The libertarian argument is that government should stay out of your lives. And so back years and years ago, when we first required people to wear seatbelts, there were debaters on the floor of the legislature in the House and the Senate who argued that this is infringing upon your rights. That, yeah, people should wear seatbelts, but the government shouldn't force them to do it. And we saw it, as you said earlier, at one point Illinois lowered its drinking age for beer to 18 on the theory that Brian mentioned earlier, that if you can go to war, that you should be able to have a beer. And then because, again, of federal pressure, because of the increase in the number of traffic accidents, particularly on the border between states with 18-year-old beer drinking ages and states with 21, people who between the ages of 18 and 21 would go across the border, have one too many beers, and get in a wreck on the way home, the federal government finally mandated that it be a uniform 21-year-old drinking age for all alcoholic beverages if you wanted to keep getting federal highway money. And of course, the states all rely on the feds for help to build highways and interstates and bridges. And so now it's Uniform 21. And I think the same kind of thing is behind the notion of the Tobacco 21. The libertarians say, as the argument was made on the floor, these are people who can get married, they can buy a house, they can do all kinds of stuff. Why should not they be able to choose for themselves whether they want to smoke or not? And the public health argument is that if you can keep people from starting as a teenager, they probably won't smoke, and there's a huge cost to society brought about by smoking.
We have seen through the years specific lawmakers take on, you know, what I'd call more of a pet issue. You know, this is something they care very deeply about. John Cullerton, the Senate president, has always been pretty big on anti-smoking, things like that. And my guess is, Brian, that if this doesn't pass here with an override, we're going to see this legislation come up again. And, of course, there appear to be that there will be more Democrats in the legislature. Maybe it will get a bit closer with a Democratic governor being able to get this through in the spring. So I don't know either way that the final verdict is going to happen here in the fall, but we could see this again in just a few months.
Yeah, based on the votes, I mean, it passed the House and Senate already. There's a chance, a good chance then that it stands to reason that it would happen again. And if Pritzker supports it, I don't off the top of my head recall whether he was asked about this particular issue during the campaign and took a position on it. But if it is something that he would support, then it seems like it would have a much better chance next year.
Well, another health issue that came up this week and has been coming up in the last few months, getting some attention during the election, regarded a plant that's in Willowbrook called Sterigenics, and it's a chemical they use. Daisy, you covered this hearing. Some people came claiming that this plant is creating health problems for people who live nearby.
That's right. So this was a special case hearing where several Illinois residents urged legislators to ban this chemical, ethylene oxide, that's used to sterilize medical instruments. So now legislators are considering several measures to deal with the issue. So the issue is that one of the plants, Sterigenics, has used high levels of this ethylene oxide gas. And as a result, residents claim that they have acquired cancer over the years and that they're being poisoned. And this is what they allege. So one of the measures is calling to phase out the use of ethylene oxide by 2022. Industry experts claim that there is no other better way to sterilize medical instruments, but some people are saying that other hospitals across the country are already using alternative methods to sterilize their equipment. So I think this is going to be an ongoing discussion. You know, even though legislation was already filed, they're still going to talk about it for different measures, and they want to make sure that at the end it's just one that they can all agree upon and go from there. Legislators, also Democratic State Senator Melinda Bush was one of the legislators at this hearing. She said that she just wants to know, first of all, how much of the emissions has impacted the communities before they even move forward with any final decision.
And that seems to be the question here, because it seems as though people are saying that they're not getting the information they need from either the state or the federal government regarding, I guess, emissions from this plant.
Right. So, you know, one side is arguing that, well, you know, it is regulated, the emissions levels. The EPA regulates that. But now they're saying that Sterigenics, for example, did not follow the levels that they're supposed to follow. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth are already calling for an investigation. They want the EPA to be more involved, the IEPA to be more involved, and making sure that they've been following and been compliant with these levels.
And I know you talked to some of the residents. There has been an issue. We're talking cancer cases. They claim that they believe there is some link there between Sterigenics and some of what people have shown up in people there.
Yeah, so one a report came out over the summer in August, late August, that told residents in these communities that they found that they had higher cancer rates in those areas, and they believed that they were connected to the emission levels of ethylene oxide by Sterigenics. So one resident that I spoke to who testified at this hearing, she said that she was diagnosed with cancer as an adult. She didn't initially make the connection to Sterigenics until her mom told her that a lot of people here have been diagnosed with cancer, and this is, might be the reason why you were also diagnosed with cancer. So now all the residents here are asking, you know, they're demanding for answers, and they want ethylene oxide to be banned.
And I know Sterigenics has said that they have operated within the guidelines. Brian, this did come up, this issue had came up during the election. Can you clarify what took place, what people are alleging at that time?
Yeah, I mean, one of the concerns during the election came out is, was the Rauner administration slow in getting information out about this? Were there warnings that should have been issued earlier? We often talk on this show about how a lot of people, you know, maybe they pay attention to what's happening in Washington, and they pay attention to what's happening in, you know, their local school board and maybe their city council, but state government is something that is kind of something that, that falls between the cracks. But an issue like this, where it really, you know, goes to your, you know, your home value as well as your personal health, and those two things tied together. I mean, you can just imagine how this has just gripped people in that area. And House Republican leader Jim Durkin, you know, made the point during one of these hearings. He said, I live about X number of miles from Sterigenics, and then going the other way is this other facility. So I'm right in the middle of this, you know, this area where this is affected. So I want to get to this as well. But, you know, he is also one who is urging a more deliberate approach and making sure that there's not an overreaction. But this is something that has really, if you live in that area, it's something that I think feels like an emergency situation. And so there's this conflicting pressure where you have people who want something to be done now, and yet you have the relatively slow machinery of government responding.
Well, something else that came up during the election, and also some allegations that the Rauner administration was slow to release information about, was the Quincy Veterans Home, the Legionnaires' disease outbreaks we saw there. Charlie, this week, legislation moving through, lawmakers trying to address some of what's left over from that, and that includes people who are suing the state of Illinois. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, basically the current law says that you can sue the state of Illinois, but you have to go through something called the Court of Claims. And there is a limit on what kind of an award you can get. You can get compensatory damages, whatever they are, but over and above that, you're limited to $100,000. And in the case of the veterans who died at Quincy through the Legionnaires' disease, the argument was $100,000 is really not a fair amount for the suffering that their families went through. So the legislature passed by pretty solid margins in both chambers this spring legislation that lifts the cap on damage awards against the state to $2 million. The governor used an amendatory veto to lower that to $300,000, and that amendatory veto. With an amendatory veto, the legislature has two options. They can accept the governor's changes. They can do that with a simple majority, or they can override it just as though it were a total veto with three-fifths. Well, it got the three-fifths in the first chamber, and now it goes to the second chamber, and my guess is it's going to get the three-fifths there too. The opponents, the few that there are, and the governor argue that, well, this doesn't just apply to the veterans' home, it applies to all of state government. So you're opening the government up to a lot more expensive lawsuits while you're trying to help these veterans' families. But my guess is it's going to pass pretty handily.
Also this week, another controversy that's been out there has been over something that you might not think there would be too much controversy about, and that is a hat that reportedly was owned by Abraham Lincoln, and it's owned now by the state of Illinois, but there's questions about this ownership. And Daisy, you went to a hearing on this. What is the latest and what's going on with this, and why is the state so involved right now?
I guess, you know, it's important to understand first the background and the issue of money here. So the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation was set up to support Springfield's Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. So they're a private entity involved with the public one and trying to help them fundraise and keep the Lincoln legacy going. As you said, Sean, during the week, legislators called for a special hearing to discuss the foundation's debt and what that means for the so-called Taper Collection, which was purchased by the foundation in 2007 for $25 million. Now, some consider this to be one of the most premier collections in the country of Lincoln artifacts. So the foundation took out a loan for $23 million to buy over 1,400 items with some type of connection to Lincoln. And now they're struggling to pay back that loan, and they still have about $9.2 million left over to pay by October of next year.
And there's talk they might have to sell some items,
so
right? Yes,
so that's one of the issues here. So they're asking the state for some of that money to help them cover that. And like you said, within this money issue is the issue of the fur stovepipe had believed to be Lincoln's. The foundation got the FBI involved for a DNA test that came back inconclusive, but they did so in a very secretive manner and did not communicate the findings with the public, who continued to believe 100% that the hat belonged to Lincoln. So now legislators want more transparency. They want to know what the working relationship is between the museum and the foundation. There seems to be some kind of miscommunication or lack of communication between both the foundation and the museum. And lawmakers want to know the issue behind the hat. And just on Thursday, a day after this special hearing, State Representative Tim Butler and State Senator Jason Berrigman called for an audit of the foundation's finances to make sure that they have not mishandled money over the last few years.
Brian, well, this is just another. When it comes to Abraham Lincoln, which the state is so proud of, we have seen problems for years regarding how the state operates historic preservation, how the state operates the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum. This is just another, almost a black eye for Lincoln and the state of Illinois. It seems to always be coming up in the news.
Yeah, it's one of those things where people want to profess to be proud of him, but when it actually comes to spending money on these sorts of things, historic sites, it comes pretty far down the list when you compare it to healthcare for people who can't afford it, or schools, things like that, even public safety, prisons. So it's always, or at least in recent decades, it's been something that's gotten short shrift from the government. And it's one of these ideas, well, we'll partner with private groups to fundraise for this, but it hasn't worked out as well as people had hoped.
Well, before we run out of time today, Brian, I wanted to mention, we talked a little bit about the election and now what we're seeing following the election. Still a few races are uncertain at this point. We don't know exactly what the majorities will truly be. Is that correct as we go forward in the legislature?
Yeah, and it's because I think we're just down to three races now. So the results in the counties don't have to be counted or finished counting, or they can't really be finished counting until November 20th. That's Tuesday, 2 weeks after the election. And that's to allow time for mail-in ballots that might have come very slowly. They have to be postmarked by Election Day, but they give them 2 weeks to actually come in the mail to the election authorities. And then you also have provisional ballots where people, maybe there was some dispute as to whether their registration was current when they were voting. They're still allowed to cast a ballot, and then there's some time taken to figure out whether they can be counted. And there's still three races, two in the House, one in the Senate, these are not good. You know, the control of the chamber doesn't hang in the balance or anything like that. But it goes to the question of how big will the Democratic supermajorities be, basically. And in the Senate, incumbent Republican Senator Connally is down by several hundred votes to his Democratic challenger there. In the House, Representative Republican Tom Morrison is ahead of his challenger. And then there's an appointed Representative Walsh, who is down by just two votes. This is in the 51st district up on the sort of in Lake County, Cook County border area north of Chicago. And, you know, for anyone who says that your vote doesn't matter, this is one of those amazing examples we hear about every few years, you know, where somebody loses by a vote or two. This just two votes separate the Democrat who is leading the Republican in this race. With the caveat, though, that this number will change because we know that they have received mail-in ballots that have come in, that the way they handle things up there is they just count them all at once at the end of the process. I would just say this is, and Rich Miller, the Capital Facts newsletter writer and blogger this week, made this point about, you know, we're so used to on election night, the way the AP reports the results is 100% of precincts reporting. And that can lead people to think that that's 100% of the results reporting. But as we move to mail-in ballots and a much greater share of people are voting by mail and early voting, these elections seems like it could well be more routine that these elections are going to be decided later, particularly in these close districts. So it might be helpful, as Rich suggested, to not use that 100% reporting language, or to, you know, find some way to clarify that this is, you know, not the definitive result on election night. Because we've now heard some politicians, including the president, come in and say, oh, they're finding ballots in closets and things like that and alleging fraud, when this is really just the way the process is supposed to work.
And Charlie, we don't.
Yeah, and it's always been that way. But in past years, there was never such a huge volume of mail-in ballots. It used to be very hard. It's almost like you had to have a doctor's excuse to get an absentee ballot. And now it's kind of routine.
We know that Democrats are going to have what may be a historic majority in the legislature going forward. So if that's the case, what does that mean for Democrats in the next session? I would think from an interest group perspective, you might say, hey, you've got nobody to blame but yourselves if you can't get these things done. So in some ways, it brings some pressure to have that many people on your side in the legislature.
Yeah, it does. And you're going to have to deliver results. And in a sense, the Democrats were in a similar position for the first couple of years of the Rauner administration, because they did have the 71 votes in the House, but some of those votes were not reliable party line votes on certain issues. And so that enabled the governor to argue that the Democrats didn't pass a budget. They could have and they didn't, but the Democrats really didn't have the votes. Now Madigan is going to have the largest Democratic majority percentage-wise for more than 50 years, and Senator Cullerton in the Senate is going to have a similar disproportionate number of votes. And so the issue will be, can the Democrats come together with their internal differences? There's a relatively small centrist group, but there's also a very large progressive group that will be wanting to push things that maybe someone like Madigan will not be particularly comfortable with. So you'll see some of that internal things. But when it comes time to take tough votes, if Madigan does have 74 or 75 members and there's a tough issue, let's say, I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but let's say they decide to raise the income tax rates. Well, he can allow or choose or talk to his members, and if there are 15 people for whom that would be a bad vote politically back home, they can take a walk. They can vote against it. He'll still have the 60 votes. So that's, in a sense, there's more responsibility when you have clear supermajorities, although with a governor of the same party, the veto overrides aren't that big a deal, because you would figure that the governor and the legislature would work together and there won't be that many bills that would be vetoed in the first place. But it does give you flexibility in terms of managing your caucus to get stuff through and have members who are in target districts take a pass.
All right, that will be it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Daisy Contreras. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and find us at NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.